So Vic, tell me about your last trip in Europe.
Sure. So last time I traveled in Europe, I went to Warsaw from Brussels, and I took a plane. It took me 1.5 hours. It was fast. It was smooth, comfy. I even had snacks on board.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. The problem is, afterwards, I realized that it was quite polluting. My return trip, Brussels-Warsaw by plane, emitted a total of 466 kilos of CO2 emissions versus 15 kilos of CO2 emissions that I would have emitted if I had traveled by train, according to a CO2 calculator that I found online.
Great that you calculated this afterwards, not before.
Yeah. Now, I have to admit that I also took a plane the previous time I traveled. I went to Nice, and I'm also going to be taking the plane in my next two trips that I have planned for this summer. I'm going to Prague in July, and then I'm going to the south of France in August. I also have to say that I did consider booking a train ticket to go to the south of France, to Nantes from Brussels. But first of all, it wasn't really clear where I could get the tickets for this trip. And then when I finally managed to navigate the SNCF, the French Railways Company, website, I realized that the prices for a one-way train ticket were a lot more expensive than flying, and that they included a couple of layovers, one in Lille and another one in Paris, where I even had to go to a different train station. So in comparison, Ryanair was a no-brainer. Their return ticket was only 70 euros. It was 1.5 hours each way, and checking luggage included, so I just went for it.
Oh, but we're not getting paid by Ryanair, by the way.
No, this is not sponsored by Ryanair. Definitely not.
But so, did you ever take a train? I mean, you seem to be like really like a flight enthusiast.
Yeah, I mean, now I really feel ashamed to admit all of this. But I do take the train a lot within Belgium. However, I don't take it very often when I travel cross-border. The last time I took a cross-border train was to go from Brussels to Luxembourg last year. This is a trip that should be quite short because the distance between Brussels and Luxembourg is only 223 kilometers. The problem is that there are no high-speed trains between these cities, which means that you must take an intercity train that stops everywhere. It's very nice, it's scenic, but it takes you around 3 hours to get there versus, you know, just 2 hours by car. If you're lucky, you can hop on a direct IC train, but otherwise you have to change in Arlon.
Yeah, that sounds complicated.
Yeah, especially on weekends, which was my case, because at least last year, there were no direct trains on the weekends, which means that when you change in Arlon, you must do the rest of the journey to Luxembourg by bus, which increases the travel time by 45 minutes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Mm. And then the other times that I've traveled by train cross-border in Europe, it was for trips to Germany from Brussels, namely to Berlin and Bonn.
Oh, those trips I also know quite well.
You do. But I have to say that in my case, neither of these trips were super Bonn. When going to Berlin, our train was delayed because at some station, the driver just decided to wait for passengers that were traveling in a connecting train that was itself delayed.
There was probably a hum happening.
It could be. And then when going to Bonn, all morning outbound trains from Brussels were cancelled without notification or explanation. So the next train that I could take was in the late afternoon. I ended up arriving at midnight to my destination. Then on the way back, the train broke in Aachen, where I had to wait for 3 hours on a Sunday. Everything was closed. I almost had to spend the night there. So, you know, that's just three strikes for trains and a resounding victory for planes.
Yeah, I think you got really bad luck. But I mean, this Brussels-Cologne connection is prone to break all the time. Oh man, this doesn't sound good. You really mentioned like a lot of issues on your last three train travels. There are no trains sometimes, or if there are trains, they are not well scheduled, or if there are trains, they break. Hmm. And also you mentioned that actually booking trains seems to be not the easiest task. And finally, also, sometimes they are quite expensive, no? So this whole topic seems to be much more complex than it seems at first sight, and neither you, Vic, nor I, we are really expert on rail. But the good thing is we invited a guest to our show to explain why it is so complicated to travel by train in Europe. And this guest is Philip Czerny. He is a consultant on transport policy, and he has worked as an advisor on transport policy at the European Parliament. So he has quite some experience on policymaking. And he was a member of supervisory board of a German railway company. And finally, he has been the chief executive editor of the European Mobility Atlas 2021. So let's listen to Philip's take on European rail on this episode of EU Untangled.
Let's hop on that train.
Philip, welcome on the show.
Thank you.
What is this European Mobility Atlas?
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me on your show. With the European Mobility Atlas, we want to get the topics that are addressed in EU transport policy out of the EU bubble. EU transport policy in general is a highly complex subject, and there are so many technicalities that are addressed when legislation is made. So we wanted to simplify all these subjects. If you have a look at the European Mobility Atlas, which is available on the Heinrich Böll Foundation's EU website, you can see that we used a lot of visual elements. So essentially, we want to narrow down all EU transport policy topics, make it understandable for everybody. I'd like to make a bit of advertisement for it. We published it first in English, but right now we have the Atlas available in French, Italian, Greek, Czech, and Spanish. So now you can read about EU transport policy, almost all kind of languages.
I actually have to say that the Atlas looks great, so I do highly recommend that everybody checks it out. Not only is it full of useful information and data, but it's also very colorful, as you just said, so it's easy to understand. You come out of it feeling like an expert in transport, even if you are not one. So thanks for the great work. I read on Twitter that you describe yourself as a transport policy enthusiast. Are you also a train enthusiast? Do you take a lot to train yourself?
Well, I just came back from Interrail trip with my parents, actually, who are in their mid-70s. So yes, I'm a train enthusiast, not only for environmental reasons, but for me, traveling by train is also a way of getting to know where you're actually going. Flying, that's on the long term, not really what I think is sustainable, both from an environmental perspective, but also from a mental perspective. I think it's much healthier for your body to have an understanding where you actually are. And very personally, I think flying really stresses me. So yeah, I'm a train enthusiast by all means.
You mentioned before that you travel by train because you like the way of train travel, but you also mentioned the perspective of sustainability. And I was wondering whether you could maybe give a bit of an overview where you think train travel is very roughly, or how the state of European rail is currently. So does it work well? Does it serve the people? And where do we need to have it in a couple of decades in order to promote more sustainable transport?
Well, let me start with answering your last question. I think what we have to have achieved ideally next year, but policy is a slow locomotive. We really have to work on cross-border rail traffic. I'm right now living in Denmark. If I head to Brussels, I'm taking the really, really slow diesel train to Hamburg, and then can profit of the fast connections within Germany. But I guess most of the listeners that sometimes travel by train to Brussels know that then again the connection between Brussels and Cologne is a highly vulnerable case. So that's really the issue we have to work on, that there are better cross-border connections. It's already an achievement that there are less and less flights, let's say, between Munich and Berlin, since the high-speed line between Munich and Berlin opened. The number of flights have gone considerably down because, first of all, the airport in Munich is not really centrally located. And right now, I think it's the train takes about 4 hours. That's about what you also have to take by a plane if you count the time for check-in. I'm mentioning this example because that's where it really works well, but we have to achieve that also regarding cross-border connections. And I think people are cheating themselves in a way when you say, hey, it only takes an hour to fly from A to B in Europe. But what you usually don't account for is the time that you have to be at the airport before your flight actually leaves, the time that it takes to get to the airport. You have to wait for your luggage, etc. So usually the difference is not that big anymore. And flying is a very interruptive way of traveling. You have to go to security control. You have to find your gate. You have to switch off your phones during takeoff and landing. All these things. You get on a train, you open your laptop, you can start working. In between, you can go to the restaurant car. I think the charm that some people don't really see from railways, that it's really an uninterruptive way of traveling and you can actually make use of the time. But by flying, that's not really the case.
If I may push back here a bit, you also now painted a rather optimistic painting of a good train travel. I myself also have to travel quite a lot by train, and I fully agree with you that the time can be used very productively, and this is not the case if you take the metro to the airport and then you have the security, and we all know the hazard there. But sometimes it takes a long time to take a train, and sometimes the train is late, and sometimes you're missing the connections, you know, and especially if you're then on a different country and you maybe don't speak the language anymore because you just traveled to, let's say, Italy, and there you cannot book a train ticket from Hamburg to Italy because for some reason the two companies don't work together, you know, then maybe people decide to fly because, yes, it is interruptive, but in the end, I guess you save some hours, no? What, from your perspective, are really the top issues, in your opinion, that have to be fixed in order to make cross-border travel with a train more accessible? Like service better, or is it ticketing, or what are the top issues we have to fix here?
You essentially already answered your questions in a way yourself, but I'm happy to go into detail. You're quite right when you address the issue of ticketing. That is a big problem. It's getting better, but not better than it has been decades ago. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to go back to state railways. Well, in Germany, we call it the Deutsche Beamtenbahn. Some decades ago, you could essentially book a train ticket from Aarhus nearby where I lived all the way down to, let's say, Athens. But that's essentially the issue. That's also the issue that the national railways are highly protective when it comes to their own market. But cross-border rail travel is only going to work if national railway companies are working together. Good example in that regard, in a way, is the ÖBB and the night trains. They kind of found a niche on the market where they run their night trains somehow in cooperation with the other national railways, France with the SNCF, with the Nightjet to Paris, together with Deutsche Bahn to Hamburg and Berlin, other cities. But I think that only works well because it's really a niche. Deutsche Bahn doesn't really have an interest anymore to run their own night trains. They, in a way, did the calculations, said, maintaining and purchasing rolling stock for night trains is too expensive. So what we do is try to kind of claim the credit for co-running a night train. But essentially, the only thing we do is providing the infrastructure, but not really contributing with our own rolling stock. I recently, as I said, did another Interrail tour, and you can see this co-branding on the night trains themselves, because you see rolling stock branded SNCF, ÖBB, where essentially it's clear it's just ÖBB that is running the rolling stock, but SNCF kind of jumped on the train, literally on the train, and pretends to also operate night trains.
I'm actually happy that you go back to cross-border train travel, because traveling by train, it's actually one of the best ways that you can travel. Railway transportation represents less than 0.5% of the EU's total greenhouse gas emissions coming from transport, and yet it accounts for almost 10% of passenger mobility, 8% according to the latest statistics, and almost 20% of freight transport, which is huge. The problem here is that only 7% of all the kilometers that are traveled by train in the EU come from cross-border travels. So it seems like people still tend to prefer traveling in a different way, be it by car or road transport in general, or maybe probably planes. You know, just look at all those cheap Ryanair tickets that keep on popping up here and there. I actually read in the European Mobility Atlas that almost half of all the European cross-border rail connections are non-operational. So it seems like there is an issue there that goes just beyond ticketing. And I guess the protection that member states give to their national networks. And I'm wondering, what other issues are there? Is it the pricing? Is it maybe the travel times? Maybe we're not investing enough in high-speed trains. Is it political will that is lacking, maybe at the national level or at the European level? I understand that it's a very complex issue, but what are the levers that maybe we can pool as decision makers? Not that I am one, but like at least I'm a citizen who votes for decision makers. So where else can we find like some possible solutions for to increase cross-border train travel?
Let me just come back to the first thing you mentioned, the still relatively high share of rail travel, but I think that is essentially commuting within the member state. But again, in regard to cross-border travels, from my perspective, rail infrastructure has historically grown, which means that we have different electrification systems, we have different signalization systems, and if you're traveling by a bus, when you talk about freight transport, by a truck, at the maximum have to change the side of the road that you're driving on. Otherwise, it pretty much stays the same. It's a highly complex undertaking that a lot of people don't really see. You jump on the train and then you get to another city and you don't really notice that in between there has been a change of the signalization system, or maybe in between you change from a electric to a diesel locomotive.
Because it's so smooth, actually, in practice.
Exactly. And you also addressed another thing that is really important. From the European Commission side, and also, unfortunately, partly from the European Parliament side, in the last few years, there's been a high focus on major projects, such as the Lyon-Turin connection, which cost more than 10 billion euros to essentially have three or four high-speed trains running per day. It's really smooth travel, don't get me wrong, between Lyon and Turin, but you really need to put it into perspective. Is that money invested really worth it, or can't we do something better with a smaller amount of money? You address these smaller connections that are still dysfunctional. In my last job at the European Parliament, MEP Michael Kramer, he was really standing on the toes of the European Commission until they said, okay, finally, we are going to invest about like 100 million euros just to kick off a project where we look at how we can close these minor gaps for rail connections. A very concrete example is between France and Germany, nearby Freiburg, Colmar, Strasbourg region. There's been a railway bridge that's been destroyed during the Second World War, but it's never been rebuilt. And that doesn't cost, excuse the word, a shitload of money. It's pretty simple thing. Just rebuild this railway bridge and you can cut down travel times, where instead you have to go up to Strasbourg and then go down again by, I think, half an hour, 45 minutes. And it's mostly connections like these railway lines lying in disuse that you just have to rebuild, work a bit on the infrastructure, and then you can really improve the travel experience. But unfortunately, it's always nicer to sell a big fancy project instead of doing the hard work on the ground, trying to find out with which improvement you can improve travel experience, travel times. I think Switzerland is a prime example of how they're really doing the hard work on the ground. They've invested in some bigger project, such as the Gotthard Base Tunnel, but mainly they're building flyovers in Zurich just to be 2-3 minutes faster in the train station, in order to be able to make another connection. They're really fine-tuning And that's what has to go hand in hand on a European level. Do both, think big, but with thinking big, you also have to do the fine tuning, because otherwise you get from Munich to Berlin in 4 hours. You get from Berlin to Paris in 6 hours, but that doesn't help me if I'm not living at Berlin Central Station, or I'm not living at the Munich Central Station. Most of the population within Europe lives not in the capitals, and they have to profit of that as well. I'm living on the island of Samsø in the middle of the Kattegat in Denmark. We have ferry connections both to Seeland, which is the Copenhagen side, and Jylland, which is the Aarhus side. I have a ferry connection in the morning that makes me arrive in Aarhus at 7:30. The next train leaves at 7:35, which I cannot make because it's a mess in connecting times. That's not fine-tuned between the different modes of transport. I have to wait for 2 hours in Aarhus to get on the next train to Hamburg. And that's just this example that I'm trying to highlight. Fast connections are important, but they have to work with local transport, etc. France is a really bad example in that regard, because some of the high-speed train stations have been really pulled out of the inner cities. There are a few train stations, especially on the line between Strasbourg and Paris, where the high-speed rail stations don't even have a rail connection. You get there with your high-speed train, but then to get, I think it's Metz, you have to take the bus for 45 minutes. It's nice to have high-speed train, but if the bus takes as long as the high-speed rail, then there's no point in that.
Well, the devil is in the details. One of the points that you make in the European Mobility Atlas is that even though there is some generous EU funding for railway infrastructure, somehow the European rail network has not been improved enough. And you point out that there are many small-scale cross-border projects that actually have very limited access to this pot of money, and that seemingly there is a tendency for member states to prioritize high-speed projects within their borders rather than trying to improve cross-border mobility, even if it just takes, you know, a few kilometers of railway infrastructure to make that connection, to literally bridge that gap as the one that you were mentioning before. So it sounds like here perhaps the European Union could do a bit more to somehow bring this funding closer to where the needs are on the ground.
Well, the European Union always can do more, but from my perspective, it's not so much about the EU, it's about the member states that have to apply these projects. Because when you do railway policy in Brussels, it's essentially most of the time the national incumbents, the national railway companies that are sitting on your lap and telling you, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. And most of the times the European Parliament has been quite progressive. At least when I was working in the Parliament, we've achieved a few things, namely the passenger rights that have been downgraded now. But this situation that the parliament is quite progressive, but then when it comes to negotiating with the council, when you go into trilogue, then I wouldn't say that the member states take the position of their national railway companies one-to-one. But it's a huge influence. And this influence obviously has this very national focus. There are only a few regions where there's really serious interest in these cross-border links. Let's talk about the region around Aachen, Liège, Maastricht. These regions are highly linked to each other, so there is an interest of having well-working public transport. Also on the German side, around Freiburg, Basel in Switzerland, and Strasbourg, Mulhouse in France, there's a high interest in these regions. But then there are, of course, other regions that are also not so densely populated. Take the border between Germany and Poland. Yeah, good links on the border, Usedom on the German side. And that's working quite well. But then on a not so densely populated border, there is not such a big interest. Now we have to prove that by investing money there, we can really change the behavior of the transport users from car to rail, from car to other modes of public transport.
But let me try to dig a bit into the question of who exactly can do that. You mentioned before the Colmar example, where there's this bridge unused. You also have been now a couple of times a bit, let's say, critical about the big incumbents like SNCF in France or Deutsche Bahn in Germany. And you also said before that at the European level, the powers are limited, although you also said for an effective cross-border travel, you know, there should actually be somebody having the big picture now to make sure that also the little connections like the one you mentioned maybe in Denmark work well. So my question is now, if the European Union is kind of like not as powerful to actually do something, but the big corporations are also not super interested in like actually improving the train travel cross-border, aren't we a bit then here in a deadlock, so to say, or how can we move forward from that situation? Do we need to give more power to the European Union in that, or although maybe this is not politically feasible, but you know, just dreaming, or is that not necessary and we just need to convince somehow the big incumbents? Or maybe as a last question, some people also say we need more competition. Maybe, you know, we need other alternative train companies that can maybe supply services where the incumbents are not willing to move. What's your take on that?
Well, let's start with the incumbents. Taking a look at Germany, I think that there's some progress. There is some understanding that something has to change. When the markets were opened up to competition, the incumbents' first reaction, of course, was we're trying to protect our markets. But now it can be seen that there are a few competitors running on the infrastructure, not that much in Germany. There's Flixtrain, but not much more. I think Italy is a much better example with NTV and, well, the incumbents with FS. But the understanding, again, coming back to Germany, is that we have a situation where Deutsche Bahn has also spread out to all different kinds of countries. Deutsche Bahn is running local trains in Denmark with Arriva. Or I have to say, was running local trains because Arriva has been sold now. Deutsche Bahn was also operating parts of the metro in New Delhi. And that's where I now see a policy change that the new government that we have in Germany, or not so new anymore, but the government we have in Germany now, they see, okay, Deutsche Bahn, the way it has developed, is on its limits. So us as owners, Deutsche Bahn is private, but 100% owned by the German government, we have to focus on the core market and we have to make that work well. And already this perception that there's an understanding that competition and making everything about earning money in all different kinds of markets, that's maybe not how a railway company should function. It's about providing services to the citizens. It's not only about making money. When talking about competition, I think competition is important to improve the kinds of services that are provided. For me, everybody always talks about Switzerland when talking about railway. But another country that I personally always love to mention is the Czech Republic, because they traditionally have a very, very dense railway network. They have affordable prices. They have competition on their network. And in general, from my experience, it's working relatively well. And the competitors are not only going in on the major routes. They are also running some routes that they somehow can find out how to make them profitable. It's not as in Germany, and that's from my perspective a personal criticism of Flixtrain, that they're focusing on the most profitable routes.
One thing that strikes me is how efforts at either national or European level to sort of make sure that there are better, faster, and more comfortable train connections, how young all these efforts are compared to how old the railway system in Europe is. At the same time, I have the feeling that there is a number of achievements at the European level that maybe we're not very aware of because now we take them for granted. Now we have charge and capacity rules that are common for all EU member states. We have train driver certifications. We have safety requirements. We have a European agency for railways that authorizes vehicles for cross-border travel. We have rail regulatory bodies in each member state, and we have now rail passenger rights that are valid in any of the 27 member states of the European Union. And I have the feeling that the European Union is always coming up with these more ambitious proposals of, like, let's double the number of trips by train by 2030, let's triple them by 2050, let's do the same for freight transport. So I just wonder what your take is on all these European efforts that have been ongoing since, I guess, the 1990s to make sure that we get closer to having a single European railway area that can be interoperable, that can be sustainable, and that can be safe for everyone to travel on.
Compared to other EU policy areas, European transport policy as such is relatively young. It's just in the late 1980s, 1990s that finally the EU got some competence in that areas. As you said, there are quite some achievements, taking into regard that we've only been working for such little time on these areas, especially also taking into regard that everything that's to do with railways really takes a long time.
It's a slow train.
It's not necessarily a slow train, but you have to consider that you need all the infrastructure in between. Setting up a new flight in between two cities, you just need the two airports in between. You don't need to build any signaling system in the skies. You need an airport in city A and city B, and then you have new connections. Of course, there are also some regulatory issues, but that's more the legal kind of, it's not so much technical. I don't want to be the one who always paints everything in black, but I also don't want to be the one who says, yeah, everything is fine when we talk about railways, because there is always ways to improve it. Like the most recent citizens initiative is asking the European Commission, hey, why don't you as EU purchase rolling stock, and the national railway companies can, not only the national railway companies, also private initiatives can lease that, because it's night trains are the best idea, in my opinion, for traveling cross-border. It craves a huge investment that usually can only be carried out by the national incumbents. I'm really impressed by, I don't want to do any advertisement here, but there's recently been the European Sleeper set up, and I'm really impressed by what they're doing, just by crowdfunding, and, they're obviously not using the newest rolling stock, but just this initiative being able to carry out such a project, I'm really highly impressed. The problem in the European institutions sometimes also lies within the leadership. They're not coming from a railway background. When you talk to them, there's a much bigger understanding for aviation, and that's then, of course, difficult to push for a policy that is so highly complex as railways are. And I think it's already been quite an achievement that we had the European Year of Rail, but there were calls to make the next year the European Year of Aviation.
That's crazy.
Fortunately, it didn't happen. That's also kind of sends the message that rail is nice, but let's do aviation next.
Mm, Yeah, I think that trains are probably not a sexy policy topic because of their complexity, just as you mentioned, because they take so long as well to implement, you know, any projects. But I think it is a very important topic. And I honestly, personally think that night trains are super sexy. In my opinion, they are the future for long distance cross-border railway travel. Because as a passenger, if I think, well, how can I get from Brussels, where I live, to, let's say, Prague or the south of France, if I want to go to Nice, anything that is longer than 6 hours already seems like a bit of a hassle. Like, I'd rather just take a cheap plane ticket and be there in an hour and a half, you know, luggage included. Yes, I have to go to the airport. Yes, I have to go through security. But I will be there in under 3 hours. If I'm lucky, I'm even going to get some snacks on the plane. Whereas taking the train, like, first of all, where do I book my tickets? How do I find the best price? And what if the train breaks down? What if it's delayed? What if I miss my connection? What if I have to sleep on the train station or book a hotel last minute? Like, all of these are barriers in my mind that keep me from even looking up train tickets, you know, if I want to travel for more than 4 or 5 hours.
I absolutely agree. And it's why I already kind of touched upon the EU passenger rights. During my time in the European Parliament, I think it was a big achievement that back then got the passenger rights as we had them until this May. Unfortunately, with the revision of the passenger rights, we have force majeure, which means that the railway companies now can claim there's been an extraordinary weather situation, we are exempt of reimbursing you. That's not been the case when we had negotiated that. And I think I want to kind of counter this argument that you just made. At least until recently, I have, of course, had situations where I traveled and a train was delayed for whichever reason. I missed a connection for whichever reason. But I've slept at so many nice hotels, either in Cologne or Hamburg, because I didn't make the last connections. And it was always Deutsche Bahn or SNCB or DSB that had to pay for it because of the passenger rights. Of course, you have similar passenger rights in aviation, but that's something that people take a lot as just that's the way it has to be like. But that's something the European Parliament actually negotiated. And it was a really tough fight. We actually wanted the same reimbursement rules for rail as for aviation. We unfortunately did not manage to get, but still, I think it's a great example on what especially the European Parliament can do for the individual citizen. A lot of people compare taking the train to flying, but flying also gets really expensive when you talk about an entire family traveling. And an entire family traveling, that's usually then by car. And then nobody gives you any reimbursement if you're stuck in a traffic jam. Nobody gives you any reimbursement if your car breaks down. So I think that's also where you have to be realistic about what you actually get for the money that you pay. But I, of course, also completely agree with you when you say it's a hassle booking train tickets cross-border, but that's again then mostly the incumbent railways that use different ticketing systems.
There is an interesting proposal coming up that has actually been delayed already for a little while. It has an awful name. It's the Multimodal Digital Mobility Services proposal. What that basically means is that travelers will be able to, you know, through a single stop shop, look for different travel options and compare flights, bus, trains, their price, the duration of the trip, their CO2 footprint, and be able to book in a single place easily their train tickets. I think that's super exciting, but I also have the feeling that there is a huge fight brewing up because then, of course, all the railway companies, they will have to share data with digital platforms. And, well, we live in an era where data sharing, it's actually the new gold. So will they do that? To what extent? In what form? Will it be reusable? Will it be accessible? What will be the compensation? Like, I feel that's probably the reason why this proposal has been stalling a little bit. But I would love to see that. I would love to have that in my phone, you know, an app just to book my train tickets. That would remove a huge obstacle. Just for kicks, you mentioned the European Sleeper. Last night, I just looked up, you know, how much it would cost me to go to Berlin to visit Alex from Brussels on the European Sleeper. And it's still quite expensive. If I want to book a ticket to go there on the 24th of July, come back on the 27th of July, I would need to pay €258 for a 12-hour train ride. Whereas with Ryanair, I would pay €200, check-in luggage included, and it would just take me under 2 hours. So even if I'm committed, this is still, you know, a bit expensive for me.
Let me highlight two things in that regard, because there's always this comparison made between Ryanair flight for €5 and the rail ticket that costs you €250. What people tend to do when they do this comparison is take the full flex ticket price for a train, which is obviously much more expensive than the Ryanair flight that cannot be changed. You're flying probably from an airport in the middle of nowhere and so on. So I just don't think that comparing these two modes of transport really does the trick.
It is probably more nuanced, what you would say. I absolutely agree. Sometimes if you fly very short term, you need a ticket for tomorrow, then flying is 100% more expensive than the train. But sometimes if you book long term, the flight can be ridiculously cheap, you know. But then also we don't pay for the harm which is done. So, you know, it's a bit of a, but still, you know, people are choosing flights sometimes if they go for holidays because they book early and then they see, oh, the train is much more expensive.
But that's also, it's a discussion that as a society we need to have. What kind of harm for ourselves, for the environment, we are ready to accept for the comfort of being able to fly for a weekend to Spain or wherever. I think what is really important on a European policy-making level is that we keep this flexibility of railways. And that's something which has gone a bit the other way. If you take a look at France, can be that if I'd be living in Brussels, I could be stuck in Paris because there's simply all trains are booked out. I could reach another city in France by only taking local trains, but that would take me a really long time. That's why I'm really, really happy about the system that we have in Germany, Denmark, essentially most of the EU member states across Europe, where you pay a higher price, but you can still get on the next train that you want. And this flexibility is highly important. I think that's also covers a part of the market. Nobody would fly from Hanover to Berlin. But I know a lot of people that are actually living in Hanover, work in governmental positions in Berlin, and they commute almost daily. And they don't know when their meeting ends in the evening. They just jump on the next ICE that's running because they're running at an hourly interval. So this freedom is really important, and that's political decision whether we want to maintain such a service. You can always just run connections that run when there's the biggest demand, and that would probably be much more profitable. But then is that really the service that we want to provide for our citizens? Is that the service that we need to achieve a change in mobility, to get people out of their cars, away from the airports and onto rail and more sustainable modes of transport? I think that's essentially the big question that has to be addressed on a political level.
Yeah, that was already a very nice wrapping up statement. Before we do wrap up, do you have any other point, Philip, we did not mention in our talk?
Something that I found out now that I moved away from Brussels to a village called Toftebjerg with 50 inhabitants. What is, from my perspective, really important when you talk about the change in mobility is that you don't forget the people in the countryside. As I mentioned earlier, it's important to have big cities connected well because they are kind of the backbone for the infrastructure. But I don't know the exact percentage of how many people across the EU are living in the countryside or in more rural landscapes. But if you don't take them along, then we won't have a change in mobility. Of course, the cities always have to be at the forefront, because from a investment output perspective, that's the first step to take. But don't forget the countryside.
It might not be economically or politically attractive, but it's socially necessary.
Exactly.
I have one last question. When is the next European Mobility Atlas coming out?
That's actually a pretty good question. We've had a first version that was published in 2021. Then we had an updated version, and now we kind of kept the Atlas going in a more, let's say, sustainable version, because we started with paper copies. We have updates on the website of the European Mobility Atlas. To be quite frank, we had quite a big change in the process of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, who's responsible for the European Mobility Atlas, just recently. So they have to get settled, and then we get going. I really want to pursue this project, because the Atlas is only interesting and a viable document if we keep it updated. So I can't name an exact date.
But let's say you're on track.
We are on track, exactly.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Philip, for giving us so much insight into some of the details of the Colmar Bridge in Germany-France border region, but also more of the bigger train situation or rail situation in Europe. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did the same.
It was a pleasure to talk a bit more in detail about mobility policy in Europe, and specifically railway policies, with you.
That was our conversation with Philip Czerny. Make sure you follow us on Twitter on EU_untangled and on Facebook and Instagram on EU.untangled.
And we also have a new account on Mastodon. Did you know that?
What? Really? Yeah. That's great.
It's EU_untangled at EUpolicy.social.
And remember that you can find EU Untangled on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and basically wherever you listen to your pods. Don't forget to give us a rating, preferably a good one, because it really helps other people discover the podcast, or avoid it if you think it's bad.
And finally, we also have a website, www.untangled-podcast.eu, where you find all the episodes. You can also reach out to us via email, of course, which is mail@untangled-podcast.eu. We would really love to hear from you.
Thank you, and hasta la próxima.
Tschüss.
Choo-choo.